Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Our producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins, and I know we record on Thursday morning. So much I want to start with, but I'll start with an actual old limerick by Skip Tenzer. Of course, he does our political limericks, and he said, Arnie, I'm sending you an oldie, but a highly relevant one. We look for reasons and causation and seek to blame it on mutation. The mass shootings continue, and the answers within you acknowledge we are a gun-sick nation. He said, Arnie, I wrote that about 3 years ago, and I keep resending it to you. And then here's my thoughts. The GOP wants to grow bullets, not babies. They celebrate overturning Roe, not to save life, but to ensure future targets. That is brutal, everyone. But let me just say something as an aside before I introduce Scott Braddock. So as you know, Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it's Friday, it must be Scott. But so my daughter left Shanghai, and she left her husband in China, and she's here alone with her two dogs, two cats, and her baby. Mm-hmm. And her husband said, you know, I'm not sure you should stay in the United States. I don't think it's safe there. He said, we don't have school shootings in China. We don't go shopping for food and have shootings. We don't go to a discotheque and have shootings. I've been talking with my parents. I'm not sure that it's safe for you to raise my child there. Okay? So this is the reaction. And at some point in time, what my fear is, if she ever goes back to China, he won't let her come home with her because he's really concerned about her safety. And I think this is just part of the thing. It's becoming all of our collective concern, and the inaction is just appalling. Anyway, it's frightening.
Well, let me say something about that, Arnie. So I was talking with some friends of mine who are from the Rio Grande Valley here in Texas, and they were talking about the cartel violence in Mexico, where you have cartels at war with each other. You may have seen recently the story about the four Americans who were kidnapped in Heroica Matamoros, which is on the other side of the river from Brownsville. And it turned out that, and this is incredibly unfortunate, terrible, but it turned out that it was a case of mistaken identities is what the understanding was from investigators. They didn't think cartels were targeting Americans. They thought that cartels were targeting each other, which is what they usually do. And they just thought that these folks were part of a rival cartel. In fact, it would be so bad, you know, for a cartel member to have captured an American and killed an American that they were those people were probably then killed by their cartel leaders as punishment because they drew attention to themselves by kidnapping Americans. So the kind of violence that's happening there is different from what we have in the United States. And that's not to say either one of these is good, but there is a fundamental difference. So with the cartels, they're warring with each other. We see this in Matamoros. We see this in Juarez on the other side of El Paso, other side of the river from El Paso. And it is the case that if you experience violence there, it's going to be crossfire between two factions that are at war with each other. What they don't have in Mexico, though, is people just shooting up a school or shooting up a Walmart or some other store, just wanton violence of people targeting people they don't know.
Right.
That's what happens in the United States. That's what goes on around here. There are people in Mexico who are at war over business interests, right? Those cartels are fighting for territory, right? That's what they're doing. Here, we have these people who just act as complete lunatics shooting folks that they don't know. And we've had this deal in Nashville now. Of course, we know the story all too well here in Texas. There was a lot of comparison, by the way, between the way the cops in Nashville behaved, rushing right in immediately to save as many people as they could versus what happened in Uvalde about, and thinking about what happened there, where the police were in the hallway for 77 minutes and didn't do anything. The threats were described to be basically the same. They were talking about the same kind of weaponry used by the shooter in Nashville that was used in Uvalde. And then, of course, comes in Texas, the cover-up. In Nashville, we've already seen, that just happened. We've already seen the police body cam from Nashville. We still haven't seen all the video from Uvalde. The Texas Department of Public Safety and local authorities there have still fought us every day of the week about releasing the full version of what happened in Uvalde. So it was another reminder for folks here just about how bad all that was and how much better the response could have been.
Let me just stop you before we get into what I really want to talk about, which I mean, I want to talk about this, but it's exhausting. There's an article that just came out in the New Yorker, and I thought you should see this. It was entitled, "What Republicans Are Saying When They Advocate for Homeschooling as a Solution to School Shootings." This became a talking point after Uvalde, right? As if that is an answer. Homeschooling. I mean, I'm just, it, to me, it is just so outrageous. Mental health, homeschooling, you know, let's find more safe rooms in schools, only have one entrance. I mean, look what they're doing. They're turning schools into prison. And then they're suggesting that your answer is, if you really want to keep your kids safe, homeschool them. But of course, you know that it takes two incomes to pay the mortgage and pay the utilities. So guess right. What happens? Where do you live and how do you survive? It's outrageous. But
anything but the gun. Anything but the gun. You talk about anything but the gun. That's the thing. It's misdirection. Anything but the gun. We'll talk about how many entrances there were, you know, there are to the school. Talk about homeschooling. Make the craven argument that if we had a school voucher system, then they would have been in a private school that would have somehow been safer. But we're talking about in Nashville, a former Christian school student,
yeah.
Right? So that argument doesn't really fly, does it? But they've got to do something about the fundamental problem, which is access to these guns, and in particular, access to guns by these young people.
So you want to talk about the Texas GOP leaders, including Dan Patrick?
Who no, shared, don't make me talk about that.
Who shared?
I don't. It's that sometimes I send my list to Arnie of, you know, what we might talk about, what things have happened in Texas, and Arnie will act as if I want to talk about those things. No, we're here doing it. I'm doing a job, Arnie.
I know.
I'm doing work to
the
talk
big
about this.
For it too. Right, yes, some sure. Texas GOP leaders, including Dan Patrick, shared the stage with former President Donald Trump in Waco. I also want to remind you, I believe Marjorie Taylor Greene was there as well, wasn't she?
Great. So. Yeah, sure.
All right, Matt Gaetz
and that whole crew.
Okay, so let me hear about the lieutenant governor. So what did he have to say?
Well, let's back up a little bit. Let's think about where this rally is happening. When we first got the news that the former president was going to bring his campaign to Waco, Texas, people immediately asked this question. Why? Of all the places in the country that he could do this rally to really kick off his campaign, because, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how his campaign for president again, I was going to say re-election campaign. That's not right. His campaign for president again would be described as lackluster, right? So far that there hasn't really been a whole lot of activity around his campaign. He's had a few events, but I don't know that they've drawn a whole lot of people. But now he wants to get back into doing his rallies. And he was talking about, you know, Trump was talking about just how much fun it is to have these rallies. And he loves, you know, interacting with the crowd. The question was asked, why Waco? Of all the places in the country, Texas is not in play in a presidential campaign. And, you know, if you think about the importance of the Texas primary on the Republican side, it's down the list, right? It's not Iowa. It's not New Hampshire, right? It's not the first state. It's not among the first states where they really have to compete right out of the gate. So why Waco? Immediately people said, oh, wait, this is happening on the anniversary, the 30th anniversary. It was 1993 of the siege in Waco, which so many on the right, and look, not conservatives, extremists. These are not, quote, conservatives. These are extremists who look at the Waco siege as some emblematic thing of, you know, fighting the government, right? I mean, we remember, Arnie, what happened in 1993 there, and most of your listeners probably do too. But just a refresher, I was having to talk to young people about it this week who said, you know, so I was talking to a young woman who was actually at the Waco rally on Saturday, who didn't really know anything about the Waco siege from 30 years ago. This is a young woman who's 28 years old. And I described what had happened there. The Branch Davidian cult led by David Koresh, who was, and you know, when people say, oh, the government was totally wrong to go in there. Look, there's a lot of legitimate debate about the way the government went into the Waco compound, right? But there's no debate about the fact that there was some bad stuff going on in there. This is one of those things where people would say, well, if they can do that to those poor people in Waco, then they could do it to you. No, probably not. You're probably not sitting on a mountain of firearms that a lot of them have been illegally modified. You're probably not pretending to be Jesus so that you can justify having sex with 12-year-old girls, right? You're probably not doing that. That's the kind of thing that David Koresh was doing in the compound at Waco.
That should be an ad. I hate to break it to you, but that should be an ad to remind people about Waco, because as you point out, this is where Donald Trump went to on the 30th anniversary, and we need that little tiny 30-second refresher. That's all I need to say.
Right. People need to know that that's the context. So Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is speaking at the event this past Saturday, and he addressed this concern that folks have about why Waco was chosen for this rally.
Language that may offend.
He does use some harsh language here. Just want to give you a warning. He does use some harsh language here. It's interesting, and I'll note the irony of this. Someone who was testifying against a piece of legislation in the Texas Senate, which, of course, Lieutenant Governor Patrick is the presiding officer of the Senate. Someone was kicked out for using the same word just the other day in their testimony. So here you go. This is Dan Patrick, our lieutenant governor, explaining why Waco was the site of the Trump rally this weekend.
Waco, because the president called me several weeks ago and said, I'm coming to Texas. I want you to pick a great town.
So he says the Trump asked him to pick a great town. He said that it was just fake news. That the site selection had anything to do with what happened in Waco 30 years ago. But I want to play one more thing for you, Arnie. So there's a reporter at the Houston Chronicle who interviewed a Branch Davidian. You know they still exist? So
no,
the Branch Davidian cult is still a thing in McLennan County where Waco is. And this reporter interviewed a guy who is a Branch Davidian, and this guy is talking about how much he appreciates the fact that Trump chose Waco because Trump can identify with the people who were there at the siege 30 years ago.
So he's making a statement, I believe, coming to these stomping grounds where the government, the FBI, laid siege on these community, just like they laid siege on Mar-a-Lago and went in and took his stuff. That's what they wanted to do here. They wanted to come in and take the guns and everything.
And stop this guy from raping 12-year-old girls. He's comparing the raid in Waco to the raid in Mar-a-Lago for, remember what they were looking for in Mar-a-Lago was alleged classified documents, right? So this is the way these people view this. Now, I want to share one other thing about this rally. During the opening of the deal in Waco, the former president was standing there with his hand on his heart as a song was performed by a January 6th choir. Did you see this?
Yeah.
So that there were people who were imprisoned in, you know, for their roles on January 6th, and they are the ones singing a song that Trump is promoting, and he was acting as if it was number one on the Billboard charts or something. I'm not sure about that. That doesn't sound right. But let's connect all the dots here. And Arnie, I think your listeners are smart enough to connect the dots. I have started to think that part of my role around here is just to throw dots at people. Like most folks are smart enough to connect them. They just need to know what the dots are. So here you have the January 6th rioters are singing in a choir, paying tribute to former President Trump. And by the way, while they were singing, on a big screen there at the rally, they were showing imagery from January 6th as if it's something to be celebrated. They're doing this in Waco, Texas, where there was a deadly siege on a compound. You remember the images from 1993, the compound catching fire as the ATF, FBI are rolling in there. There was one other event that shares the same anniversary. Do you remember what it is?
No, I don't.
The bombing in Oklahoma City.
Oh, that's right. 2 years. Yes.
Now,
Right, that's right.
Now remember Timothy McVeigh,
right,
who was the Oklahoma City bomber, I have been to the site, I have been to the memorial. You know that when the truck exploded outside the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, the killing was indiscriminate. Babies who were in the daycare there were incinerated. And remember what Timothy McVeigh said his inspiration was for the bombing. Was the raid in Waco. So put all these things together, the raid in Waco, the deadly raid there, the Oklahoma City bombing, January 6th. So I was talking about this with one of my friends here in Austin, who said, you know, if you went back 30 years ago and you took our politics that we have now and did an overlay, put it on what was going on in 1993, remember at that time, you had conservative thought leaders like Rush Limbaugh saying, look, we condemn this violence. We're not to blame for this. You know, we talk in a certain way and people are acting as if, conservative talk show hosts, specifically Rush Limbaugh, are somehow inspiring this kind of violence. But Limbaugh would say, no, not me. And think about the difference now with Trump celebrating January 6th. If you took our politics now and went back to 1993, Trump and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick and others, they would be calling Timothy McVeigh a political prisoner, right? Yeah. They would be calling him, but they might be calling him a hero,
right?
I mean, this is the kind, this is where the Republican Party has gotten with what Rick Perry called a malignancy. You remember when Perry was running for president briefly? It's the way we first met. When Perry was running, he was calling Trump and his brand of politics cancerous, malignant. And of course, in the meantime, he had to go back on all that and hit the brakes on all that and embrace Trumpism just like the rest of these Republicans. And it seems like there's really no path out of it for Republicans. I mean, we talked just recently about Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, who is pushing a lot of the same ideas as Trump. Of course, he's just sort of pitching himself as he's Trump without the baggage, so to speak. You saw where Ron DeSantis sort of made fun of Trump's problems with porn star Stormy Daniel. I thought what he said about it was kind of funny, but you saw the backlash from, you know, the supporters of former President Trump who didn't appreciate that. And I've come to think of it this way, Arnie. I think this line works better in Texas, but I think you'll get it. When it comes to DeSantis trying to beat someone like Trump, you can't sell Mr. Pibb unless Dr. Pepper's not in the restaurant. So that's where he is in his campaign.
That's a great line. Yep.
They're still in the thrall of Trump. And when you see one of these rallies I think there were about 20,000 people there in the Texas Sun on a Saturday celebrating what happened on January 6th, we still have a big problem.
When so much of the Velcro that holds your base together is hatred and cruelty, nobody does it better than Trump. And that's the Velcro. That's what's holding them together. It isn't about the policies that DeSantis is doing. They don't look at government. They don't look at policies. They look at the fact that they need someone to sort of focus on all their grief and all their anger and give them a target. That's what Trump does, is he gives them a target, which is just so scary. And that's part of the reason why the whole thing is just absolutely outrageous. I want to point out that we know that the individual that was responsible for the mass murder in Nashville was a transgender woman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at your other topic. The Texas House this week held a marathon hearing on whether to ban so-called gender-affirming care for children who transition from one gender to another. That follows mm-hmm. a dramatic hearing in the Senate about the same thing last week. Obviously, the events of this week are only going to heighten and intensify the conversation.
I would think so. People always point to the exception to the rule to try to prove that the rule doesn't exist. But I would say the opposite is that who is always committing these crimes? It's in general young men.
Yeah.
Right. Young men. And I was talking to a Democrat about this yesterday who said, look, it's a trans woman. That means that's a person born a man. Am I wrong? So yeah. That's what they said. That's what they said. So yeah. That's what this Democrat said. So it's once again kind of moving the goalpost for no.
And it's as a young man
talking about in general here.
But think about it. It's a young man that went to a religious private school. So he checked all the boxes for them, okay? In the sense that he wasn't in public school. He was at a private school. He was at a private religious school. So when you look at all these things, it's like none of their storylines work with this mass murder. None of them.
It's really a weird deal, Arnie. And, I think that in listening to so much testimony for hours in the Texas House and the Texas Senate about what is called gender-affirming care, what some Republicans call genital mutilation of children, as it was pointed out over and over again in the testimony about this legislation, that surgeries in general are not something that's really happening with young people. We're talking about the use of hormones and puberty blockers and all of that. This is a Democratic senator, Jose Menendez, who is from San Antonio, a state senator. He is questioning the author of the ban on gender-affirming care, a woman named Donna Campbell. She is a Republican senator from New Braunfels, Texas.
It strikes me that your bill seems to get between the parent, their relationship with their child, that this bill seems to do that. Why do you think we need to have this bill? Why did you bring this bill before us?
You know, I got into the Senate for government because I wanted government out of our lives. I'm a doctor in the ER. I saw insurance companies and government getting in between the doctor and the patient. But if there comes a time when a profession such as the medical profession cannot regulate itself to protect patients, protect children, when the government needs to step in.
Oh, now it's time for the government to step in. On all of these things, Arnie, I thought it was interesting to listen to a former Republican lawmaker from Texas who I was visiting with this week, who said, you know, it used to be, and he's talking about 15, 20 years ago, used to be that when Republicans would come to the state capitol in Austin, they would just want to get through the session, not do much damage, and go home. And that's the way it was always sort of thought about. But now Republicans, and think about the way this is all turned on its head, now Republicans have a government solution for everything. If there's you know, something that you know, is upsetting to the conservative base, if there are you know, certain grievances, the grievances of former President Trump included, then we need to come up with a government solution for it. And so what are we doing? We're talking about banning gender affirming care. We're talking about banning drag shows in Texas. We're talking about banning certain books. So there, let me give you another discussion.
Banning curriculum, banning CRT,
banning curriculum. There's a proposal to ban certain books in Texas public school libraries. And the author of that legislation is a guy named Jared Patterson. He's a state representative from Frisco, Texas. And during the hearing this past week on his legislation, he was asked whether his legislation would end up banning books that he doesn't intend for it to ban. Now, remember, we've seen this in Florida, where in Florida, the governor there and Republican legislators targeted what they called sexually explicit content in school libraries and at school campuses. And the problem with this legislation is not that it would keep porn away from children. Republicans and Democrats all agree about that, right? If you take these things at face value, and the value proposition is, well, we're going to keep porn away from kids, everyone agrees with that, right? But the problem is that the legislation doesn't just do that. It is written in such a vague way that other pieces of literature would be banned as well. So the author of the legislation was asked by a Democrat, well, what about a book like Lonesome Dove, which is, as you may know, one of the quintessential works of a, you know, piece of fiction about Texas and Texans. And first of all, the author, who was from the author of the legislation, had not read Lonesome Dove, so he didn't know what was in it. My thought was, if you want to get porn away from kids, that's great. If we're going to have somebody lead the charge on banning certain books, it would be nice if they had ever read a book. That would be a good start, right? The author of this legislation admitted in the hearing that a book like Lonesome Dove would be banned from a school library under his legislation because it includes references to sex with a prostitute. Here's how the questioning went on that. A Democratic lawmaker asked the Republican lawmaker, is sex with a prostitute patently offensive? Which is one of the standards that's in the legislation. The answer from, is sex with a prostitute patently offensive? The answer from the Republican lawmaker was, quote, yes, close quote. But then he talked about how he had not read the book. And so he was going to take the Democrats' word for it that the book would then be banned. But I'm here to tell you, he doesn't have to have read the book to have acknowledged that the book would be banned under his legislation. So would the Bible, by the way, because it also makes reference to prostitutes, right? And a whole lot of other things that people might call, quote, patently offensive. And here's how you know it's not an honest argument. Here's how you know this is not being done in good faith. In another state where a similar piece of legislation was proposed, it failed. The Republican, and this is a Republican legislature, the bill failed because the Bible would have been banned under the bill.
Right.
In Texas, the bill we're talking about here specifically exempts the Bible.
What? Are you kidding me?
No.
Oh my God.
It was done to specifically address that issue, which is what killed the bill with another Republican legislature. So it's just not being done in a good faith way. And I do think that, you know, this attack on public school libraries, look, again, if you want to keep porn away from kids, please do that. You should also probably have a discussion about kids looking at porn on their phones, which is the way that they actually look at porn. That would be a good faith discussion. But I do think that this is more about tarring and feathering our public education system, as the governor wants to push school vouchers. And it's just more of a, I think it's more of a broadside attack. It's part of a broadside attack on public schools that also includes the attacks on the way that they handled the COVID-19 pandemic, right? I mean, we never stop hearing about how the schools were shut down, masks in schools and all that sort of stuff. And look, at every level of government, whether it was your local school district, your county, your city, your state government, the federal government, look, they all had screw-ups when it came to COVID. right? I mean, we'll probably for the rest of our lives be debating exactly how it was handled and whether certain things were overreactions. But I do think there is a faction out there that is trying to use the mistakes of our local school districts, which were trying to act in good faith to keep children safe. But any mistakes they might have made, it's being exploited to try to push the school privatization effort.
So I just want to remind you, I don't know whether it's in this bill in Texas, but I believe it is in the bill in Florida. And that is, anyone can challenge a book. You don't have to be a parent. You don't have to live in the city. You don't have to live in the county. Virtually anyone can challenge a book. And the sooner there's a challenge and the book must be removed, Scott, it then gets evaluated, but no one tells you what the timetable is for evaluation. So look at how ludicrous this is. Not only do you not have to read it, not only do you not have to be a parent, not only do you not have to have a nexus to that community, but, you know, I mean, you have it immediately removed. So I just want people to understand what this is about. And then just one last thing before we let you go again, Scott. Yeah. So we were talking about the transgender stuff. And one of the things we keep hearing from Republicans is mental health counseling. Guess what, Scott? She was getting mental health counseling. She was getting.
Never the gun.
All right, there we go. Just
never the gun.
So, you know, her parents.
Never the gun. It's everything else.
Everything else. Exactly. Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it's Friday, it must be Braddock. Thank you so much. We'll talk next week.
Thank you, Arnie. Talk soon.
So this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Ornison and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
As was widely expected, Donald Trump got indicted yesterday. I don't know how this will end up. I have a feeling this doesn't end up with him doing a lot of time for this. And the truth is, given the degree of criminality in which Trump has been mired for decades, this seems like an odd case, an odd thing to actually get him indicted. What this amounts to, in layperson's term, is a payoff which is sleazy, but not entirely illegal, but he used campaign funds and essentially lied about it and tried to cover it up. Is that enough to indict him? The grand jury seems to think yes. The political fallout of here should be clear, and that is this. First, this helps Trump in the Republican primary. It helps him mobilize his base, and it helps his grievance-based narrative. In MAGA world, everything that happens is a cosmic injustice against Donald Trump. And this certainly feeds that narrative. It hurts Ron DeSantis, who is having trouble getting traction as Donald Trump sucks up all of the political oxygen in the Republican Party. But more important than any of that, it ratchets up the tension, it ratchets up the anger, and it ratchets up the potential for violence and instability, which Donald Trump will stoke basically for the rest of his life. The Mitchell Minute is a brief and hard-hitting daily comment about political events from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear the Mitchell Minute every day, you can subscribe on my YouTube channel.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps, not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Interference in the 2012 election.
Oh, yeah.
Which was so bald-faced. And he really was Putin before Putin. His ambassador, I can't think of his name right now, he's still very prominent in Israeli politics, was an American. The Israeli ambassador to America was an American who had recently taken on Israeli citizenship, who had been a student of and worked closely with and remained close allies with Frank Luntz, and he hired a Republican political operative to be the Israeli ambassador to the United States before undertaking a series of interventions, pictures with Mitt Romney, appearance in Republican attack ads against Obama. He should have paid a much higher price for it, but we tend to let those things go.
It is remarkable the extent to which the Israeli far right is basically funded by America,
by our far right.
Yeah, it goes both directions. And I just learned when I was writing this article that Baruch Goldstein, the guy who committed that massacre in 1994 in a mosque where he killed 29 people, was actually born in the United States. A wild alliance between, ultra conservative, Jewish folks, but also like far right evangelical Christians who think that like part of their dogma is that in order for the end times to happen and Jesus to come back, all the Jews in the world have to be gathered into Israel, where they will all be killed by the Antichrist or whatever.
It began in 1984, which was almost a million years ago. I was the political director of something called the Nuclear Freeze Campaign. And it was a mass movement peace effort seeking bilateral arms reduction between the United States and the Soviet Union. It was then that I began noticing Republican grassroots politics. And the thing that made the biggest impression on me was that, the degree to which all these Republican evangelical types were cozying up to Israel. Because, and by the way, as a part of that apocalypse, all the Israelis were going to die and go to hell. Okay.
Yep.
So like a part of the deal is you're all dead and then you're going to our hell, where there'll be even more anti-Semitism. And I remember thinking you can go to bed with your enemies. You just can't go to sleep, and these guys were all, they were all in this pack together. And it reversed what had been throughout my life and the generation before, which was that Republicans liked oil more than they liked Jews.
Yeah.
And therefore were highly suspect, were known for their, for a kind of subtle anti-Semitism, not unlike the British aristocracy, but that your average Jewish person could smell instantly. And of course, they cared about oil so much. And so they were basically considered and were unsympathetic to Israel whenever they could get away with it. And Democrats, of course, were the great supporters. And it's never quite reversed. But, Republican candidates often now get 25-30% of the Jewish vote. And it's all about that. And the community itself, a couple of times I've given speeches in synagogues, not since COVID. And the rabbi has said to me on two different occasions, I'd be coming to speak about politics or social justice or something, and they'd say, don't talk about Israel. And the reason being that their own congregations were so divided about it. Not that they were afraid that I would insult the whole congregation, but that the people within the congregation would start yelling at each other once you brought the topic up. And that's, that's a pretty deep fault line.
Why would Jews tolerate this? They know the Republicans seem to hate them, but they're willing to take their money. Why would Jews tolerate this?
I mean, I think it's just how the project of like right-wing nationalism lines up. And I think it kind of underlines how the project of Israel itself is kind of a dubious one in terms of, you're trying to create a homeland for the Jewish people so that like the Holocaust doesn't happen again. But then you have this like right-wing settler colonial government that is explicitly lining up with some of the most overtly anti-Semitic forces around the world, like Viktor Orban, and sundry other, you know, anti-Semites in Eastern and Central Europe with the possible intention of getting people to emigrate out of those countries and come to Israel itself. That's a a risky proposition, you know, if we take the lessons of history, certainly.
It's, you know, and everything from West Bank settlements to the capital in Jerusalem to making war in Iran to generally disliking Muslims. There's so much they have in common. It's a utilitarian alliance in part. And and I would, you know, up until just the last few weeks, I always declined to use the word fascist in relationship to anything having to do with Israel, for perhaps obvious reasons. And Netanyahu is one. By the classic scholarly definitions, what is it, you know, how do you define a fascist? He, like Trump and Putin, he checks every single box. And just about, almost as much as those two. There is this global Modi, Putin, Trump, you know, it's such a long list now. And the Likud and the broader coalition it's a part of now, they're major players in that coalition. There's no question about it. And so when I'm always urging people to use the word fascist more freely, you know, it they're not Nazis. None of the people I named are Nazis. So, you know, they're not, it's not Hitler, but it's Mussolini. You know, it's the next thing. You have to say it out loud. You have to tell their followers what team they're suiting up for, so they know where they stand and perhaps have a chance to have a better idea of what it is they're doing.
Yeah, and this, you know, this is the argument of my article today, that, you know, you have this state which is premised on, you know, explicitly now Jews being a top class of citizens, like an apartheid system, basically. You have separate subcategories of second-class citizens and then non-citizens in the West Bank and Gaza. And, you know, the result of that has been to totally undermine the democratic character of Israel itself by empowering, you know, the far-right fringe that wants to maintain that domination at all costs. It's exactly how the government in South Africa worked before 1994. And the result is that, you know, people who believe in democracy, you know, the sort of centrist to, you know, center left to center right people who might, you know, value democratic institutions and not corruption, not having a corrupt prime minister you can't get rid of, they're left out in the lurch, because most of the people who would vote for, you know, some kind of like reasonably well-behaved democratic type of party can't vote. You know, there's like 5 million people, 5 million potential voters who are under the control of the Israeli government who can't vote. And they can't vote because it's a nationalist system set up with an explicit racial hierarchy. And it's just an impossible needle to thread, I think, over the long term. You know, either you're going to end up with some kind of Hungary-style quasi-authoritarian or full-blown authoritarian leader with all the attendant abuse, corruption, secret police, and everything, or you have to like actually set up some kind of democracy, you know, either one state solution or two states possibly. But the occupation and apartheid is just eating the whole project from the inside out.
Well, I agree with you there.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
We're seeing here in the United States, we have so much to learn from what's happening there and everywhere else. But here in the United States, the last shred of hope I have for the preservation of the democracy lies in the fact that the judiciary hasn't been totally compromised. And so there's still places where if you lie, you can pay the penalty of perjury, where a jury of your peers may actually end up parsing the truth under rules that we all can embrace and that we require. And what Netanyahu's done with the judiciary, he does a nice job of dressing it up and parsing it and pretending that it isn't what it is. But given the nature of their system, the fact that the government doesn't appoint those judges and the fact that a single vote majority of the Knesset can't overrule them is all that protects an independent judiciary. And they're going to quash it completely. And that's the rule of law. And in a democracy loses the rule of law, it loses itself. And they're teetering right on the brink. And there's nothing that Netanyahu wouldn't do to hold on to power.
Yeah. Yeah, because if he loses, you know, if he goes back to a private citizen, he's going to go to prison for corruption.
Yeah.
Fraud and breach of trust and taking bribes. It is a bit of a thorny question, though, I think, in terms of like the judges and democracy. Just as we are recording this, there's a Texas district court judge who issued a nationwide injunction striking down the part of Obamacare that requires insurers to cover pre-existing
conditions.
And what's the word for it? You know, just like ordinary maintenance care, preventative care. Based on this cockamamie reading of the, you know, it's unseverable or whatever, just total right-wing gobbledygook. And, you know, basically ruling by decree that this law, which was passed back in 2010, you know, is absolutely covered under the constitutional, like, delegation of the authorities of Congress, just taking it onto himself to strike it down. You know, you see this also with that case mark, whatever his name is, the other district court judge in Amarillo, who's constantly doing this and may attempt to ban abortion pills nationwide. One of the two, that is.
Kaczmarek,
yeah, that's the one.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's a difficult balance, I think. You know, like in Israel, you have an elected demagogue who is attempting to just trample over the courts as the only obstacle to his own power. But in the United States, we have demagogue courts that are trampling over the legislature to cement their own power. And in the case of the Supreme Court, especially, the fact that they could choose their own successors by timing their retirements makes it all but impossible that Democrats will ever recapture control of the Supreme Court. You know, you would have to hold the presidency continuously for like 20 years, you know, something like what FDR did. Maybe it could happen if you had a couple of, you know, lucky quote unquote deaths, you know, but it's not at all guaranteed that we'll win the next presidential election. And certainly you probably lose one in the next two or three. And that's probably as long as it would take to break a 6-3 supermajority that can basically rule by decree. So I don't know. It's tricky in both directions, I think.
Unless there are term limits, and that's not likely to happen.
Term limits, which are supported by something like 70% of the public and not strongly opposed by anybody, and which are just another example of Democrats not doing one thing that Republicans do that the Dems should always do, which is keep repeating a core argument over and over until it reaches enough people to get the political saliency it takes to pass a bill. There could be a term limits movement that could really catch on and if not end up being passed in some constitutional amendment way, become law in some other in another way. It could happen, but not tomorrow. And otherwise, I agree with everything you said. But I said earlier about the U.S. judiciary and the rule of law, there are still enough left. There are still enough judges, enough appeals court judges, of the Republican judges in the federal judiciary. A lot of them are Bush judges that have limits to what they will do, who are more like John Roberts than they are like the rest of the vicious ideological hacks who make up the conservative majority on the court. There are enough of ours. There are enough limits even to some of what some of the Trump judges will do, as we saw in that election. It depends from case to case. In some kinds of issues, you can still walk into a U.S. federal court and expect to have some close approximation of justice. And there are other kinds of cases in which you already no longer can. We lose the next election, and the darkest feelings about this will come through. Yes.
The prospect is alarming, certainly. Okay. You know, imagine where they could go with the 7-2 majority. And that, you know, it's funny that it's one of the decisions that this reactionary Supreme Court has issued is the Bruen case that struck down New York's like century old gun control law. And I was, you know, I think it It's just a perfect example of the level of hackery that these, it's just like gobbledygook nonsense. I was reading about how when he was in Virginia politics, James Madison, the guy who literally wrote the Second Amendment and most of the Constitution, proposed two gun control bills for the Virginia state legislature. They didn't pass, but it indicates that Madison thought this was an absolutely legitimate form of government. In fact, the laws were very restrictive. It was like, you can't carry a firearm outside of your own property unless you're serving in the militia. So, you know, a total ban on any kind of carrying, as we'd call it today. But, you know, these goofballs just say, well, something, something, history, something, major questions, something, something. Yeah, you can't have gun control anymore. And more mass shootings, please.
The Alito opinion was so packed full of lies. I've thought that the entire Second Amendment crowd should be compelled, like Alex in A Clockwork Orange, to be strapped into a movie theater to watch Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood film. They love Clint. He loves them. And then just at the end, you get up and say, did you notice anything? And the thing would be, did you notice that when Richard Harris got to town, they took his gun away because that was the local ordinance, no guns in town, period. And did you know that that was actually true in scores and scores and scores of Western towns? The so-called Wild West had strict gun controls laws everywhere you look. And did you notice that in the entire 19th century, no one bothered to litigate because it never even occurred to anybody that the Constitution said otherwise? It just, we had to be, you know, 200 years after the founding, before the idea even arose in a serious way. But you can't, it's where we are. The only, you know, we have to make the best argument we can in the middle and then defeat them every chance we get.
It's hard to think of a more obvious application of state authority. Like, is it permissible to regulate the production, distribution, and purchase of lethal firearms? Like, this idea that anybody, even like children, should be able to go and buy a handgun without any sort of restrictions whatsoever is, I don't think that it would have even occurred to anyone during the, you know, founding to argue something like that. It's so incredibly crazy that only modern Republicans could come up with it.
Maybe there ought to be more lawsuits against the people who sell guns.
Yeah, this is the thing, you know. People sometimes compare it to like the drug war, you know, we can never restrict the flow of heroin or whatever because it's too easy. You get a black market going, blah, blah, blah. And that's true in that case. You know, you really can't stop the flow of simple illegal drugs, methamphetamine and so on. But one area where the government actually did succeed in basically extirpating the flow of a particular drug was Quaaludes. Remember Quaaludes from the 1980s and all the, you know, Wall Street movies and whatnot? That is basically, doesn't exist. You can't get it anymore. And the reason is you need an advanced factory. It's a difficult thing to make. And it's got to be some kind of a legitimate business with a lot of complicated and expensive equipment to produce that stuff. It's, you can't cook it up in a trailer lab. And guns are exactly like that. These are difficult things to manufacture. Not impossible. You saw that guy in Japan who assassinated the former prime minister with something that looked like it was made out of plumbing supplies. But, you know, when you're talking about especially like these really the high-tech AR-15, you know, this is a lot of complicated manufacturing, very finely tuned machining parts, annealing and forging and whatnot. You can't make that stuff up in your own. You could make like a black powder rifle. You know, I've seen people do that, but you can't make an assault weapon in your backyard. And I think, you know, sensible gun control actually could work to reduce the there's too many guns in circulation today, but you could certainly have a lot of prudential rules that would reduce the rate of violent crimes in this country.
Well, allow people to sue manufacturers and sellers.
Listening to the chorus, the the right-wing chorus this week on Nashville is basically killer's gonna kill. just like the poor will always be with us. You know, there's nothing you can do about corruption. And of course, there's all this evidence that whenever we seriously legislate about any of these problems, we solve them. That it's not that hard operationally to make any of these things work. And that even though it's harder to do it at state level than by quite a bit, it's harder to do it state by state than it is to do it nationally. But even then, the states succeed. And of course, what we've done is we've struck down their ability to do so. If I were a little bit more of a totalitarian than I am, and frankly, I'm close as it is, I would have a decree if I were in charge forbidding the Federalist Society from ever calling themselves that again. It's such a joke. Their complete contempt for federalism, which has its legitimacy in many aspects. I'm not as sympathetic to it as they were when they started, but I'm way more sympathetic to it than they are now. And, you know, it just, as you were saying, whether it's a single judge or the U.S. Congress, anytime a notion that seems even faintly progressive, in fact, even centrist, they're there to strike it down. They're there to prohibit people from acting at a local or state level. It's sickening. So anyway, I would just, you know, take that word away, make them call themselves something else.
Yeah. They do support federalism in a sense, in that wherever they happen to be in power, that's where they should have the maximum leeway. If they run the city, they want to be able to do whatever they want. If they run the state, they want to tell the cities to do whatever they want. We're seeing this in Tennessee, actually, right now, where the state government is sort of gleefully bullying Nashville because they got a nice New York Times write-up one time, apparently. State Republicans are really mad about that years later. And then when they're in federal power, they want to tell all the blue states what to do. And that, you know, honestly, it seems like part of the core of conservatism now is pushing those states around, you know, inflicting a punishment on them gratuitously.
Well, with the threat of secession.
That's right. Yeah, we're going to.
And by the way, I'm not for secession, even though I think that the Northeastern United States would make a lovely country, you know, if it came to that, a dozen or so states. But I'm not for it for a bunch of reasons. However, if they fire on Fort Sumter this time, I don't think there are going to be that many volunteers to hold the Union together. I don't think we'll fight quite as hard on our side as we did last time. That's just my intuition.
Well, that the reality is the southern states or the states that call themselves secessionists, the ones that wanted divorced from the rest of the country, they're kind of a drag on the rest of the country.
Yeah, it's more of an emancipation, by the way, if you will. It's an ironic phrase to apply here, but you know, it would basically mean that we can stop supporting them, you know. And it's just like, you know, if you're like a bad child who's finally, you know, I'd love here in Connecticut or New York, we just stop paying all their tuition bills and let them support themselves for a while. See how that works out.
Yeah, let's see. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Our time is up. Thank you for putting up with our problems.
And I need to say goodbye to both of you, Robert Henley and Bill Curry. If it is Friday, it must be The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze on Monday, everyone. Ciao.